Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Barbara Massey, Vice Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Michael Spector. Michael Spector has been a staff writer at the New Yorker since 1998. His most recent book, Denialism, How Irrational Thinking Hinders Scientific Progress, Harms the Planet, and Threatens Our Lives, was published this year. Mr. Spector writes often about science and technology and public health. Since joining the New Yorker, he has written several articles about the global AIDS epidemic, the current epidemic of swine flu, as well as about avian influenza. He has reported on malaria and the world's diminishing freshwater resources. He has written articles on synthetic biology and the debate over the meaning of our carbon footprint. He has also published many profiles of individuals, including Lance Armstrong, the ethicist Peter Singer, Sean P. Diddy Coombs, Manolo Blahnik, and Michuya Prada. Mr. Spector previously worked for the New York Times. He served as the Times Moscow Bureau Chief from 1995 to 1998, and later served as a roving foreign correspondent based in Rome. He came to the Times from the Washington Post, where from 1985 to 1991, he covered local news before becoming the Post's national science reporter and, later, the newspaper's New York bureau chief. He has received recognition for his work. He was given the 2002 AAAS Science Journalism Award for his article, Rethinking the Brain. He received the Excellence in Media Award from the Global Health Council twice, first for his 2001 article about AIDS, India's plague, and secondly for his 2004 article, The Devastation, about the ethics of testing HIV vaccines in Africa. In 1996, he won the Overseas Press Club's Citation for Excellence for his reporting from Chechnya. I'd like to now present to you Michael Spector. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here. That introduction always makes me sound way better than I am. And I've never been gaveled in before. This is the first time that's ever happened, so I'm doubly excited. I wanted to talk to you a bit about my book, Denialism, and some themes that run through it. And the first thing I should probably do is tell you what I mean by denialism, because it's a word that gets used in different ways by different people. I think we all know what denial is. We get depressed. We have a problem. We don't face it. It can be something very serious or not. And it's, I think, kind of a common human trait. And it's not even necessarily a bad human trait. It just happens. And as long as it's brief and you get over it and move on, I think it's probably fine. Denialism is sort of denial writ large. It's when a society acts that way. And when that happens, they don't tend to get over it, at least not our society. It gets deeper and it festers. And I think we're seeing that in a number of areas of life right now in this country, and I think it's extremely damaging. And some of these things don't at first seem that damaging. They seem like victimless crimes or personal choices. I would argue that they actually are not. And we can start with one that's in the news a lot these days, which is the H1N1 flu vaccine. 40% of Americans say they won't have this vaccine, 40%. 11 million doses have been given. There's been one serious adverse reaction reported so far. There will be more. I'm not saying there will only be one out of 11 million. Let's say there are 19 out of 11 million. There are 5,000 dead people so far. There will be many, many more dead people, even if the flu remains very mild. A lot of those people are kids. The idea that somehow that vaccine is more dangerous than the flu, just given this data that we can all see, is remarkable to me. And it's remarkable to me how often people say, it's a new vaccine and we don't know anything about it. It's the same flu vaccine that comes around every single year. The only reason that it's at all different, well, there are two reasons. One is the virus is new, but the virus popped up 2 months too late to be folded into the seasonal vaccine. Otherwise, there wouldn't be an H1N1 flu vaccine. There would just be a flu vaccine. But people just don't seem to want to recognize that. And the problem is, I was at a party, actually, last week, and a woman came up to me. She was pregnant. And I had written a little thing in The New Yorker about the flu, and she said, oh, you're the flu person, which, believe me, that's the nicest way anyone describes me these days. I said, I am. And she said, well, I'm certainly not getting that vaccine. I said, that's good, because you're exactly the person who should have it, so it makes perfect sense. I said, do you mind me asking why you're not getting it? She said, of course, I feel fine. This is an educated and sophisticated person, is not a moron. I have this conversation all the time with Harvard graduates. It's not about education. It's about inchoate fear. And I said, you know, everyone always feels fine about viruses until they get them. I know lots of people who were fine about AIDS until they got infected with HIV. You know, hopefully she won't get sick, and hopefully if she does get sick, it'll be mild. And that's usually what happens. But it isn't always what happens. And usually when you get in a car, you don't have a car accident. And if you do, it's usually not terrible. But we seem to want to wear seatbelts, because if you do get in a real accident, you want that seatbelt. And to me, the flu shot is just the same thing. And I cannot understand why people won't have it. Unfortunately, I have a few ideas. You know, I have a website for this book, and people send comments, and some of them are helpful and some are very punishing. I got an email from a college classmate of mine recently who said that she agreed with some of the stuff I wrote, but that she certainly wasn't going to vaccinate her daughter for polio, because polio isn't here. We don't have polio. Why would you do that? Why would you risk vaccinating your child for polio? Now, polio exists in the world. It just doesn't happen to exist here. Nobody's died in America of polio in some time. I really hope that continues to be the case, but I doubt it will be the case, because if somebody gets on a plane in Nigeria and is infected and flies to the Bay Area, that person isn't going to be known to have polio. That person may well not know he has polio. That's the way infectious diseases move around the world. And the idea that we could somehow ignore that, the longest flight that exists in the world is shorter than the shortest incubation time for an infectious disease. So there's no disease that takes longer than a flight. So the idea that we can somehow protect ourselves from any disease that exists without vaccinating ourselves, when we have this tool. And this tool isn't just a tool. It's the most effective public health measure in the history of the world, except, I think you could argue, for clean water. The most effective one there has ever been. I have a friend who's a pediatrician, and his dad was a pretty well-known pediatric oncologist in New York a while ago. And he told me a story, and this was a generation ago, about a kid having lymphoma, a really very serious illness in a bad case, and he treated him, and he beat it, and the kid recovered. But his mother was very much anti-vaccine. And 2 years later, he got the measles and died. Now, it's always terrible when somebody dies of something that they don't have to die of. But could you imagine having your kid go through that kind of agony to die of something so preventable? Hundreds of thousands of people do die of the measles in the world every year. In this country, that hasn't happened lately. It will happen soon, because the measles vaccination rates are scandalous. They keep plummeting. In Southern California, they're particularly bad. They're not so fantastic here. And on Vashon Island in particular, they're horrible. Why is that? Well, there was a purported link between autism and the measles vaccine. And I say purported because these things sometimes, there's never not a reason for these feelings. This made intuitive sense. A kid develops normally until he or she is a year and a half old, and suddenly he loses his ability to function properly. It happens to be about the same time you get a bunch of vaccines. So what's a person going to do when their child gets deathly ill? They're going to look for things that happened around then that could have caused it. And it's totally proper, natural, and understandable that people would make that association. absolutely makes sense. So it was tested. It was tested in dozens of studies in scores of places with about 3 million children. And it's actually not one of the hardest things to test because there's been a lot of kids who are vaccinated and a lot of kids who weren't. And when you compare the kids who were vaccinated and the kids who weren't, and you look at what rate they develop autism, it's exactly the same. And I'm not talking about exactly the same for 10 kids or 100 kids. I'm talking about over kind of millions of kids in 13 countries over geographic time with different ethnic backgrounds and economic positions. How could that be a coincidence? But the people who believe this scream louder and louder, and they feel that it's a government plot. I'm not even making this up because I get a lot of this email, and it's very troubling to me. And I think part of the reason is that fear is just as infectious as any disease that I could talk to you about today. And that's kind of the larger theme of this book. Denialism isn't just about saying no to vaccines, or I write about food and vitamins, race, genetics. These are things that people often react with their gut. And when they step back, if you step back and look, you're not reacting properly. It's just that this is about our unwillingness to apply critical thinking and intelligence to the issues we confront every day. And again, the harm is tremendous, because if you don't vaccinate your kid, it's not just your kid who could be sick. He or she presumably goes to school or camp. Those kids can get sick. And by the way, if you have a child with cancer, you can't send your kid to a school like where children haven't been vaccinated, because that kid has an immune system that's compromised and he relies on vaccines. And we ought to rely on vaccines. We ought to be delighted that we have them, because they've been so stunningly successful that we now have actually forgotten those diseases existed. And that's part of the problem. People don't think about measles, because who's seen measles? Most of our doctors, the young pediatricians, haven't seen measles. They certainly haven't seen polio. They haven't seen yellow fever, smallpox. These are things that killed lots of people, and not hundreds of years ago, about a generation ago, a generation and a half ago. We wiped out smallpox. I could be wrong, but it was like 45 years ago. It killed billions of people. So this isn't that long ago, and yet the fear, the sort of ideology, replaces skepticism. So we don't look, it's fine to say, gee, you know, I don't know about these vaccines. It's not only fine, you probably should do that. But we replace actual information with just ideology. So you can throw the studies I just mentioned at people. Doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter to them. No amount of data can matter. And some people have said to me about this book already, why didn't you write about two of the biggest issues in denialism, climate change and creationism? I went to the Creation Museum in Kentucky while reporting this book. I encourage you all to do that. And I came away thinking that if people want to believe that their ancestors rode around on the backs of dinosaurs, I can't contribute to the conversation they're going to have. There's nothing I can say that's going to be useful. With climate change, it's a little different. I just think it's such an overwhelmingly clear phenomenon, and the cause is us, and that is overwhelmingly clear too, that for me to write a chapter in a book about it would be kind of like putting a feather on top of a mountain. I wanted to write about things that people didn't always have the same take on. And food is something that I write about in this book, and this is something that I think is probably the most contentious thing I write about in this book, because the fight that goes on, and it goes on day and night, between people who are organic food religionists and people who believe that genetically engineered food can solve the world's problems, is one of the most useless and idiotic fights in the history of American culture wars. It's absolutely inane. There's no such thing as genetically modified food. It's all modified. There's no food we eat, not a grain of rice, not an ear of corn, that was here when the earth began. They didn't have tangerines and cantaloupes in the Garden of Eden. We bred those things over generations with lots of genes. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work. It took a long time. Now, what we can do now is more efficient. We can shoot a gene into a plant with a gene gun, and we can use one gene. And that is both better and scarier. And it is scarier, and I think one of the problems here is people haven't acknowledged that this is a technology that, it's not just that it carries risks, it makes us feel very uncomfortable. And I can understand that. But I think if we talked about it, it wouldn't go away, but we could understand it. Most of the time when I talk to people who are very firmly opposed to genetically engineered food, it quickly becomes apparent that what they're really opposed to are multinational corporations controlling food. And that is something worth talking about. I'm not going to talk about it tonight. It's a complicated issue, but it's a different issue than science. Science isn't a company. Science is a method of proving whether something works or not. So if you don't like the fact that Monsanto has control over seeds, fine. We can change that. We can deal with that. There are political mechanisms to do that. If you don't like the way Delta flies around, people don't call for the end of flight. I mean, really, this is terrible. And then people will say synthetic chemicals and pesticides are associated with genetically engineered products. And they are. And it's been terrible what's happened. But they're also associated with conventional farming because they were before there was genetically engineered food. And they're associated with organic food because organic food uses chemicals. And chemicals that those chemicals can be very dangerous. What we need to do, and we're doing it now, is step back from using things that destroy the earth, whether we use genetically engineered food or not. And this is seems in California like some sort of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, because we can go with Alice Waters and buy Swiss chard and, you know, vine-ripened tomatoes. And I do. I buy organic food. I eat it. I think it tastes better, and I live in the rich part of the world. 1 billion people go to bed hungry every night. 1 billion. In 35 years, we are going to have to figure out a way to grow 70% more food on this planet than we do now. That's not really a figure that is in dispute a lot. You want to hear a lot of people yelling and saying that's exaggerated. I'm not a mathematician, but it seems like there are two ways to grow more food. You can use more land, or you can get more food out of the land you use. We've already cut down a hell of a lot of rainforests, and that's what we'd have to do to use more land. And there are ways to use science to further the prosperity of humanity. That is what's happened ever since the Enlightenment, at least. And the idea that we would walk away from it is, while it's ludicrous in America, it's murderous in Africa. You know, Africans subsist on something called cassava. Many, hundreds of millions of people do. It's a foodstuff that's just basically a bunch of carbohydrates. It doesn't have nutrients. It doesn't have vitamin A. It doesn't have protein. It kind of sucks. But that's the choice they have. A bunch of scientists in this country and in Europe have decided that it would be great to engineer the things into cassava that would keep you alive, keep you from going blind. And they're doing it, and they're doing it with great success. So if you're stuck eating cassava, it may not be all that tasty, but you'll get your vitamin A and you won't go blind, and you'll get protein that you need. And to me, this is an absolute triumph of science. This is proof of where we have moved and are moving in human society. But to a lot of people, it's just some sort of arrogant hand of man interfering with nature in the way that nature should function. And, you know, you want to go live in sub-Saharan Africa and say that, fine. But those people who say that live in this country. They live in Geneva. They live in Europe. They don't live in Ghana or Kenya or South Africa or Botswana. And it just, it's very hard for me to understand or accept it. I know that a lot of this is anti-globalization. I know this people feel uncomfortable about corporations and government. And they have every reason to, actually. You know, when I grew up, when I was little, there was just sort of this feeling science would prevail. It would solve all our problems. It would cure cancer. All the pills would work. If there wasn't enough water, it would just take salt water out of the sea, and that would be fine. We could take care of every sort of geographical and logistical and demographic problem. And if we couldn't, we'd just go live on another planet. It's no problem. We really spoke that way when we, you know, that's really true. And I think as I grew up, we had things like Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. And I watched the spaceship Challenger explode and DES babies. And I could name, and in my book do, name lots of other things. And the sort of accretion of detail made us realize, you know, science may not be a lie, but it's not exactly the Holy Grail either. And we need to understand that science is a tool. It's a great tool, but it can be used badly, and we can make mistakes with it, as we always have and always will. So part of this problem is we have don't trust authority and don't trust institutions, and we don't do that, I think, because we used to trust them too much. And we have to come to some middle ground. Be skeptical. Don't just take the vaccine that the government tells you. But look, go onto the CDC website. All the data is there. You don't have to be a scientist to understand this, by the way. People always say, well, how can a normal person? If I say 11 million people have gotten a vaccine and one person has gotten seriously ill, and the people who haven't gotten the vaccine so far, 5,000 or 6,000 have died, I don't think that many people would have that much trouble understanding which is the better bet. But we make these choices every day. Everything we choose to do entails a risk. What are you going to eat? Are you going to get into a car? Are you going to fly? These things are risks. We don't think of them as risks, but they are. And we don't think of them as risks, so we don't process them. But we do think of swallowing a pill as a risk. And we particularly think of it as a risk if it's something like a pill from the evil big pharmaceutical companies. I was on a radio show this morning and got a lot of calls. And one of those callers said, we have to look more carefully at the motivations of the people who are making drugs and vaccines in this country. Okay. I actually don't know that we need to do that, but let's say we do. Fine. Why don't we look at the motivations of the alternatives that people seem to embrace so vigorously? What do you think the corporations who make the vitamin C that you take that does nothing, or the antioxidants you take that does nothing, are they out to make you feel good, or are they out to make money? They're out to make money. I'm sorry, but they are. And every study, you can go into any vitamin store in this city or any city in this country and take vitamin D, buy it. Vitamin B for some people, folic acid certainly for pregnant women, some iron. There are a couple other examples. But 97% of those pills should be put in a plastic bag and thrown into the ocean because they're of no value except unless you like dark urine, because that's all they do. And every magic elixir and potion and antioxidant, it's nothing. It means nothing. It does nothing. And we've had hundreds of studies with hundreds of thousands of people that not only show that, but show that it often causes harm. I have one chapter which talks about this. It's called The Era of Echinacea. Echinacea is one of the most popular herbs there has ever been. It's completely useless in preventing colds. It's not only useless, if you're a kid and you take echinacea, you have a fairly significant chance of developing a respiratory infection. Whereas if you didn't, you wouldn't. So echinacea, millions of Americans take it. We can't get people to stop taking it. Maybe fish oil works. Maybe it doesn't. We know it works in food. I mean, there's a kind of simple answer to all these things. Eat food. Eat food that's balanced. Michael Pollan writes this. He's right. Be able to name the food you eat. If you're eating things with long, broken names that you couldn't possibly understand, you might be in trouble. Get exercise. Get sleep. I mean, I hate to sound like your grandmother, but these things are the things to do. You're not going to solve your problem by running into a vitamin store and running away from the drug companies. Now, the drug companies, to me, I don't actually believe they're pernicious. A lot of people do. I think they're part of the capitalist system. I have a Mac computer. I always have them. No one ever gives me one for free. They don't give poor people them for free. They don't give cars out to poor people for free. If you're a shareholding company, the job of those companies is to make profits. Now, we can say, and I think probably should say, that that doesn't work for lots of things in this world. And vaccines are one, drugs are another. But we need to do something about that. And yelling at Merck isn't going to be the thing that works. And I picked Merck for a reason. I wrote about something called Vioxx in my book. I did that for two reasons. One is I wanted to show that there were some good causes to be denialists in this country. Vioxx, for those who don't know, was a kind of miraculous non-steroidal anti-inflammatory for people who have arthritis. There are millions. They kind of are stuck choosing between aspirin or Advil or pain. And aspirin usually only takes you so far, and it has lots of complications, and your stomach not only gets upset, sometimes you bleed, some people die. Same with Advil. And we're talking about taking this a lot for a long period of time. Vioxx came along and it was sort of the magic bullet. It took all the pain away. It didn't have the stomach distress. It was great, except that it was killing people of heart attacks. And the FDA estimated, it's a rough estimate, it could be more or less, that 55,000 Americans died as a result of taking Vioxx. Now, that's exactly how many people died in Vietnam, American soldiers. 55,000. So this is a hugely disgraceful and shameful episode in American pharmaceutical history and our life, and it was treated as such and should have been treated as such, and the drug was taken off the market, and everything was done to compensate victims as it should have been done. But I would like to suggest that we shouldn't have taken that drug off the market, and here's why. We know what the problem with Vioxx was. It's very easy for humans and their physicians to know. Do you have heart disease? Do your parents have a history of heart disease? Do you have diabetes? Are you overweight? Have you ever had any sort of stroke or anything like that in your family? These are things, high cholesterol, these are things that are easy to find out. And if we had a system, and we do not, where drugs were used properly, those drugs could be prescribed properly to the right people. Instead, when a drug's approved in this country, it's basically let loose onto the world like a bird. And any doctor can do whatever he or she wants. And they do. And on TV, people in pain were seeing these advertisements over and over and over again. Take Vioxx, you'll be dancing. It showed people sort of dancing in the streets who could hardly walk the day before. Who wouldn't want to do that? But I guess I would say, if you went to people who don't have heart disease, they would probably have about a 1 in 175 chance of having a heart attack if they took Vioxx 4 times a day, every day for 18 months. So if you went to such a person with lots of pain and said you have a 1 in 175 chance of having a heart attack, you won't have any pain for the next 17 months, what do you think? I think you'd find a lot of people who would take those odds. And those are pretty good odds. They're just as good odds as things like aspirin. You know, if every single American took 2 aspirin right now, 630, 500 would be dead by midnight. Absolutely. So that doesn't mean we should take aspirin off the market. There were 19 billion aspirin tablets swallowed last year. It's a great drug. But it does mean that we have to look at the benefits and the risks of everything we do. And we don't do that. And particularly with pharmaceuticals, I find it amazing that we've sort of evolved into a society where if a drug kills a person, it's bad. If a vaccine kills a person, it's bad. It doesn't matter if it saves 3 million lives. If it kills 3 people, it can't be approved. I'm not even really exaggerating. You know, if we regulated cars in this country the way the Food and Drug Administration regulates drugs, no one would be allowed to get into one car anywhere in this land. Really, honestly. And by the way, if we just lower the speed limit by 10 miles an hour, we'd save about, I may be wrong about this, I think it's about 8,000 lives a year. It's certainly thousands of lives a year. We know that. We know we're killing a lot of people. We're going to continue to kill a lot of people, and that we could lessen that burden by driving slower. We're not going to do that because we want to get to the mall. And that's, we're willing to accept those deaths to get to the mall. Absolutely, statistically clear that there's a correlation. But it doesn't matter to people because they're so hung up on the things they want to think about and the things they want to feel. And, you know, again, I'm just seeing danger in all of this. The vitamin thing, many people have said to me, is a victimless crime. If someone wants to take vitamin C, vitamin E, it's their business. I don't think that's true, and I'll tell you why. I spent a lot of time in South Africa where a guy named Thabo Mbeki decided that Western drugs were a plot against his people. And he refused to give antiviral medications to the people who were infected with HIV. At the time and now, South Africa has the worst AIDS epidemic in the world. Mbeki, and this isn't my figure, it's the Harvard School of Public Health figure, killed 500,000 people in 7 years by doing this. That's a lot of murder from the leader of your country. And he did this, and instead he and his health minister gave out garlic oil and lemon. That's what they served their people, because antiviral drugs were made by evil Western pharmaceutical companies who were out to kill their people. This is murder. I mean, that's what it is. It's murder. And we go, I do think it's a slippery slope from embracing alternatives as if they were tested, tried, and true, and finally saying, hey, that drug that we know works isn't as good as the garlic oil. We know, we have a scientific system. It's called the scientific method. It works. We try things out. We test them. We repeat them. We move forward. If it works, we're happy. if it works less well than something else, we throw it away. That could be true for vitamins. That could be true for any supplement. If something does pass that kind of test, and it's a test that's worked well for this world since the Enlightenment, then it isn't an alternative medicine. It's medicine. It's just part of the therapy that you would rely on because you know that there's some benefit, and it's a benefit that can be quantified. And if you can't quantify it, then it's just magic. And that's what we have. We have magic. Andy Weil is a guy who's really famous. I write about him in my book. He's, you know, Mr. Vitamin Guru. He's a smart guy, well-educated Harvard medical person. And he believes that our healthcare system sucks, and he's totally right about that. And his view is we need to be closer. We need to be intimate with our physicians. We need to communicate. This cold, metallic, distant world of medicine has to stop. Okay, I think that's probably a good idea. I went on the internet and went to his vitamin advisor. And within 65 seconds, I'm not exaggerating, he recommended 13 vitamin pills for me that would cost me $1,348 a year. This is his idea of touching me and deeply communicating with me. I filled out in 5 or 7 questions on an internet form. And he was ready to ship away. He didn't know anything about me. He's never met me. I've never met the guy. So why is that any less horrific than these pharmaceutical companies who very often do bad things? I'm not an apologist for corporate greed. I just can't stand it when it's suggested that these people who are just as greedy and just as bad are somehow have a little halo over their head. And people believe that. And when they believe that, they're turning away from the truth and they're turning away from facts. And I think it's really got some horrific consequences, and they're becoming more and more evident in this country. It's not just the vaccine stuff. It's not just the food stuff. We're now entering an era of genomics where we're going to be able, with some precision, it's early days, to predict what diseases we're going to have, how they're going to be developing, and use specific targeted drugs. This isn't going to happen tomorrow, and it's not going to be a miracle. None of this stuff ever is. Part of our problem is we always pretend that it will be. People are very anxious about it. Since the Human Genome Project was completed, there was this mantra zipping around the world. Race no longer matters. There's no such thing as race. And it is true that I'm sort of 99% the same genetically as a Swedish woman or a Nigerian man or a Japanese kid. That is true. It's also true that I'm 93% the same as lettuce. But more than that, race can help people. It doesn't have to be a horrific term. It's been used that way. These things have been used wrongly for years and years and years. That doesn't mean they have to be used wrongly now. There are different reactions that people have to drugs. Many African Americans react to medicines more acutely than some Caucasians. It depends which medicine. Some women react differently than men. We know this. Albuterol is an asthma drug. Hispanics from the West Coast take it and it doesn't work. From the East Coast, they take it and it works well. They're genetically different. These things aren't the defining characteristics any more than writing your age down on a medical chart is. But it's information worth having. And we don't want to have it because the legacy of that word is so bad. And it is bad. It is horrible. And there are lots of examples in human history of using race to do the most evil things humans can do. But can we not use words properly? Do we really have to let them become unmoored from their meanings? I don't think that has to be the case. And I guess right now we're facing an opportunity, I would say. And climate change gives us that, believe it or not, gives us that opportunity. I've written about synthetic biology, which is the ability to basically create organisms from chemical scratch. And it's very promising and equally scary, I would say. There are some examples of this having already worked. There's a drug called artemisinin. It's the most important malaria drug in the way that it's produced now is it's grown in Asia and Africa. And it's subject to the whims of weather and whether farmers are healthy enough to do it and working the right way. And if you don't get it out of the ground and process it rapidly, the leaves get cyanotic. I mean, there are lots of problems, as there often are with crops. A guy named Jay Kiesling, who works at Berkeley, is a brilliant person. said, let's figure out a way to make this drug from chemical scratch. And he did. And right now, we're on the verge of being able to make all the artemisinin we need in the world in a vat, in a factory. And it's going to be cheap, and it's going to be reliable, which is very important because it isn't reliable now, and there's a lot of counterfeit drug out there, and there's resistance to that counterfeit drug. And this is an example of what I think is miraculous. It doesn't mean we shouldn't worry about the ill effects, because we should. And there are going to be problems. We're trying to make fuels that don't burn greenhouse gases. And Craig Venter is doing this, as, among others. And he always talks about booting up a new form of life. And I wish he would stop that, because it's kind of scary. We don't necessarily want to boot up new forms of life. But I think most of us wouldn't mind having a system where we could make gas that powered our cars and our factories that was acceptable in terms of cost and didn't destroy the environment. And I think that's really possible. I don't think it's utopian. We're not there yet, and we're going to have to focus on it. But in order for that to happen, something much more important would have to happen first, and it's never happened before, and that is we need to have a dialogue. Part of the problem with genetically engineered food is it just came. It was unleashed on the world. It was mostly given to Midwestern farmers so they could grow corn and soybean, and that's mostly to feed cows in ways that are really kind of repulsive and have them shot with hormones and shot with antibiotics, which one should never eat. And that is what genetically modified food seems to be to most people, and it's understandable. But it can be something different, and it's beginning to be something different. The same is true with the products of synthetic biology. Yeah, there's Frankensteinian ideas out there. I wrote a story a year or so ago about some scientists around the world who were taking extinct retroviruses, viruses that really hadn't functioned in hundreds of thousands of years, and putting them back together and making them infectious. And, you know, people read this, and they often had this same reaction I did, which is it's amazingly cool and awfully scary. And I wondered, why would someone do this? There's a guy in New York named Eckhard Wimmer who created polio from scratch. He was denounced, and he was denounced by a lot of people, including this people. And I wrote about him, and he called me, and he said, you're completely wrong. You don't know what you're talking about, and you're wrong. I said, excuse me? But I went and saw him, and I spent a day with him, and he was absolutely right. Because what he was doing was not trying to figure out cool ways to make polio. He's trying to figure out cool ways to make vaccines instantly so that when new viruses appear, and they always will, we can react quickly. H1N1 vaccine, it's a good vaccine, and we're moving pretty quickly. It's grown in eggs in Pennsylvania. It's exactly what we did at the end of World War II. That's a kind of long time ago in science. We're still doing exactly the same thing. And we ought to be able to look at these proteins, take them apart, stitch them back together, and figure out ways to make vaccines. That's not beyond us, but it brings up lots of scary issues, because then you start tampering with the roots of life. You do. And we have to decide whether we want to do that. And the only way we can decide whether we want to do that is to do this shockingly dangerous thing of talk about it. And no one ever does talk about these things. I say in my book, and everyone thinks it's utopian, we should have high-level national conversations about this stuff, and they should be led by the person who runs our country. And I know he's a busy person, but he has a town meeting about the economy, and the economy is really bad, and it desperately needed a town meeting. Global warming isn't as bad. You know, the future of medicine and healthcare isn't as serious. I think these issues are as serious, and I'm in no way suggesting that synthetic biology, no matter how successful it could possibly be, will solve all these problems. But I kind of feel about it as I do about genetically engineered food. I'm not sure we can solve our problems without it. We have not moved forward without science for the last 300 or 400 years, and I don't understand why we're going to start walking away now. You know, a kid born in Bangladesh today, will live longer on average than a rich man born on Park Avenue 100 years ago. That's just amazing. That is an amazing fact, and it's not by chance. It's because we believe in this effort, the scientific method of things that work and things that don't work, and we know how to find out what they are. And it just kind of saddens me to see us decide that that's not as important as our intuition. So I'm going to stop here. I could hector you more. But maybe you guys will have questions, and thank you.
Thank you. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this program with the Commonwealth Club of California is a program with Michael Spector, and you are listening to his speech on denialism, how irrational thinking hinders scientific progress, harms the planet, and threatens our lives. Our thanks to Mr. Spector for his comments here today, and we're ready to take questions from the floor. So if anyone would be interested in giving us a question, we're happy to take
it. I think you have to come up to the microphone. I think that's the rule.
Just so that our listening audience can hear your question, too.
Hi.
Hi.
Very much enjoyed your talk.
Thank you.
First thing I guess I'd like to do is to confess to being an echinacea-olic. And
I still love you.
That's not the question anyway. I have to say that I, whether it's mental or not, I feel like it has some positive benefits.
I should say that that is a factor. I mean, the placebo effect does matter. It's just that it doesn't matter enough for all of this. But there's no question that there's a placebo effect, and it's very, very vigorously evident.
So anyway, after that confession of mine, the real question is the I heard you mention briefly about injecting antibiotics and hormones into animals. And I think you said, do not do that. Do not eat that sort of
That would be my personal wish.
It stems from the fact that my wife and I have been kind of going on and on about the safety of milk from cows that have been injected with somatotropin and antibiotics. And I just would like you to further elaborate on that. Are you saying that milk from those cows is not safe?
No, I'm not saying that, and there's tons of data that shows it's safe, but I wouldn't want to drink it because I don't see why we need to eat food that's been injected with antibiotics and hormones. We have our own hormones. It can't be good. We know it's not good. It creates resistance to antibiotics, and it's just to do things to animals that if you watched what happened, you'd want to run away and cry anyway. So I think there are other ways to deal. And in fact, if you really cared about the earth, and I don't do this and I'm a hypocrite, you'd just stop eating meat. Because eating meat is the most environmentally ruinous thing that can be done in this world right now. But I do eat meat, I have to tell you, so I'm a bit of a hypocrite there. Anyone else?
On the subject of both South Africa and denial,
mm-hmm.
There are many people in South Africa who think that Mubeki does have AIDS, that he spends a suspicious amount of time in hospitals in Switzerland, and he's just another example of denial.
I don't know anything about that, and I don't actually care. All I know is that there's tons of information. There's almost, you know, in 2000 there was an international AIDS conference in Durban, and there was something called the Durban Declaration where 5,000 of the best virologists and molecular biologists in the world got together and signed a petition saying, this is why we know and believe that HIV causes AIDS. And this is an irrefutable fact, at least as irrefutable as anything can be. And so I don't care if the guy's sick or not. I just know that he turned away from this information and he killed his people. The other stuff, you know, doesn't matter to me. I should also say that Jacob Zuma, his successor, 2 weeks ago stood up and denounced denialism by name and said, we have to get drugs to our people. And it was a great moment. I'm sorry it came a decade later than it should have, but it was still wonderful. And, you know, I know a lot of AIDS activists in South Africa, and I got 25 emails within minutes of that. And it was just a delightful thing. So you can win. It's not impossible to defeat denialism, but it takes a little effort.
Second comment would be that isn't this just part of fact that we are no longer children of the Enlightenment, that we have given up the scientific method to return to emotions?
Well, I'm arguing against. I mean, I think that we're somewhere in between, and I don't think that we necessarily are walking away from the scientific method. I think we kind of take these things for granted. You know, with vaccines, for instance, we just take them for granted because they work, and we don't have those diseases, and we don't have to dwell on them. And I guess I don't buy the argument or don't want to buy the argument that we're no longer a rational species and we're just going to move backwards towards darkness, because the scientific method has really done a pretty good job for us. And I think we just need to remind people of that.
Would you suggest that, would you accept the possibility of perhaps better facility with numbers, better quantitative analysis,
being able
to do statistics reflexively would perhaps be helpful?
Yeah, it's funny. I spoke at Google today, and we talked about this a little. I have a teenage daughter, and she takes chemistry and physics, and that's fine. But she's actually clearly not going to be a chemist or a physicist. I wish they would give her a statistics class. I wish every kid in America. That's something we need. That's something that would really be valuable. I'm not saying physics wouldn't be. It's just that physics isn't universally needed for everyone. Statistics is needed universally from anyone who wants to, like, buy an alarm clock, to buy a drug, to figure out what time to wake up in the morning. These things matter. And, you know, our education system is hurting, and particularly with science. If you look in 1996, they give these international science tests, comparative tests all the time. We're kind of where we were in 1996, flailing about a little. You know, if you look at China, India, Hong Kong, Singapore, I think Japan, but I might be wrong, they're all like this. They're all going off the charts because they care. And the idea that we can't lose our grasp on intellectual supremacy is, it's crazy. There's lots of evidence in the history of the world of people losing what they had when it came to sort of technological forward-looking leadership. So, yeah.
I'm beginning to see denialism creep into the U.S. political scene, and it's becoming, to the point of scary, I mean, because you keep thinking that the press at least would denounce some of the, let's say, non-facts and so forth. But in order to have a balanced perspective, point of view, they're representing stuff that's, on the face of it, is completely obviously incorrect.
Yeah, you're not blaming the press for any of this, are you?
yes, I am.
When I was younger, when I started writing about AIDS at the Washington Post, there was a guy named Henry Dannemeyer. He's from around here. He is a lunatic right-wing congressman who believed that AIDS was visited on humans because homosexuals brought it on. And he said that, and he believed it. And there was some big story someday. I can't remember even what it was. But it was going to be a front-page story, and it was 6 o'clock, and my editor came up and said, "Are you done?" I said, I am, but I haven't been able to get a response from Dannemeyer. And he just looked at me and said, "Do you know that there aren't two sides to every story?" And, you know, that seems obvious, but at the time it was quite a revelation because newspaper journalists, I was on a show a couple weeks ago, CBS Morning News, about vaccines, and it was Sunday morning, that's what it was. It was me and Paul Offit, wonderful vaccine person. He developed rotavirus vaccine and writes about it quite eloquently. So we talked about these things that I'm talking about. They put a woman named Barbara Lowe Fisher on. Barbara Lowe Fisher is in charge of the National Vaccine Information Center. She's an anti-vaccine activist. She's the most eloquent. She got just as much time as we did. Now, I really think the data is on our side, but there's a feeling like these guys get 7 minutes, she has to get 7 minutes. And this is ridiculous. It's just really terrible. I agree.
I talk a lot with people about climate change and so forth, and I find the experience of talking to some of my friends and acquaintances who I know are quite intelligent, responsible, caring citizens and so forth, but they just refuse to acknowledge the scientific basis for climate change and global warming. So in your writing and analysis of all of this kind of thing, what's the best way to have an effective dialogue with somebody to change their way of thinking or to get them to at least look at it with more of an open mind?
You know, I've been asked this. I'm starting to think that I should have written about this more in my book because it's obviously more of a – the data is so powerful and the effects are so clear. I mean, when the prime minister of the Maldives, did they have a prime minister? They had a cabinet meeting underwater a couple weeks ago. Yeah, that's a publicity stunt. But the fact of the matter is it drew publicity to the thing that you need to notice. These islands are going to be wiped out kind of soon. They have malaria on the Himalaya Mountains now. You tell people this. They never used to have that because it was cold up there. But it isn't cold up there anymore, so you have mosquitoes up there. All sorts of things are happening very visibly that didn't happen before, and they're not good news. And I just think if people are spoken to rationally, they can respond rationally. I get a lot of, it's too late, it doesn't matter anymore. And that worries me more, because I don't think that's true. I think if everyone, for instance, if everyone cared and gave up eating meat one day a week, or one of the times you eat meat a week, if you eat meat three times, do it two times, it would be staggeringly of great value. I mean, there are things we can do as individuals, and I refuse to take the attitude that it's too big a burden, let's not do it. But I think we just have to talk about this stuff, and I don't think we talk about it enough. And also, I think we scream about it. So there's the denialists, and they're the guys who think science can solve everything. And, you know, neither is totally true.
Both.
Okay.
Given that we have a current controversy over a scientific study, the recommendations regarding mammograms, I'm just curious how you would review the coverage that journalists have been giving to that issue.
It hasn't been very long since that study came out, so there hasn't been a lot of coverage. It's been a little hysterical, like most coverage is. I think it's a really difficult issue that makes people, women, but men too, upset, because if you're a 42-year-old woman and you've been told you should do self-breast exams and have mammograms and then suddenly you shouldn't, it kind of pisses you off because you don't know what to believe. And I understand that, you know, thimerosal is this preservative that people worried about with regard to autism. And they took it out of vaccines a decade ago. And they did so for idiotic reasons. Parents were screaming, so they took it out. And the American Academy of Pediatrics joined with CDC and said, people are upset, let's not use this anymore. So 2 weeks ago, Governor Schwarzenegger lifted the ban on thimerosal because we kind of need vaccines with thimerosal because there's just not enough vaccine without. So I got a lot of calls from people saying, I don't know what to do, because the truth is, if you say something isn't of harm and then you take it out of a vaccine, what does that tell people? It isn't really a message full of confidence. And I think that's what's happening here. But I think there's something more that's happening here, which is that data accrues. You know, science moves on, we get more information, and sometimes we have to change our position. And that seems to be the case here. And another truth is that money isn't endless. And we probably should be spending the money we're spending on those mammograms on research on breast cancer. It would probably be a much better way to spend the money. But that's a difficult issue, and it's a difficult issue to write about, which is why I haven't yet. Not true. No time.
Just a question about your career arc. I'm wondering, Moscow Bureau, designer shoes, scientific denialism. How'd that happen?
I like a lot of things. I mean, I wrote about politics at the beginning, and then I wrote about science at the Washington Post. I decided I wanted to go overseas for the experience of it. Science is the only thing I've ever done all the time and loved and never got bored with. But I was married, and I was working at the New York Times. We went to Moscow. It was just a great adventure, and I enjoyed it. And I go back, and I love Russia. I was living in Rome, and I came home from Tanzania one day after watching a bunch of kids die of AIDS, and the editor of The New Yorker, who was an old friend of mine, called and said, we want you to write a story about this fashion designer. And I said unmentionable profanities. And, you know, we don't do the thing at The New Yorker where they make you do stuff. And so he backed off. And then he called me the next day and he said, you know, it would just be good for you. You would have fun. It's okay to have fun. So I said, fine. I went up to Milan and I wrote about this guy, Lauren Steele. He's an African-American designer who lives there. And it was fun. I went to London with him. And there was this guy, Manolo Blahnik, I never heard of, who's, I guess, the most famous shoe guy in the world. I never heard of him. But he's larger than life. And so, you know, once a year, I would write stories like this. And I won't write fashion stories anymore because they kind of have a sameness. But I'll do other things like that because life's too short just to write about death. It really is. I mean, part of what I do for fun. And it's fun to write about those things once in a while. I mean, I wouldn't want that to be the defining thing of my life. Go ahead.
I wondered if you'd had a chance at all to look at the incidents of the cell phone thing with...
Not intelligently. I mean, I can't say it's, you know, I'd like to say there's nothing to that. And I think the early data suggested that there wasn't anything to that. I don't know enough to say that definitively, and it would be silly of me to comment. I know a lot of studies are being done, so I'm not the guy to ask.
When we're making decisions on things that have to do with science, where do you suggest the public go for information?
That's a good question. It depends kind of what science. I find if you go to the websites of like the Harvard School of Public Health, Memorial Sloan Kettering, even NIH, even the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, which I argue shouldn't exist, their website's really good and factual and has lots of interesting stuff on it. It is a problem. And the problem is that the web will give you anything you want. If you have a supposition, whatever it is, you can find support for it on the internet. And sometimes it's really hard to know what's useful and what isn't. Actually, we were talking about this at Google today because they're very good at sort of ranking by popularity, you know, things that keep coming up. And they're trying to figure out better ways to rank by sort of truth. And it's very hard. And I think we're kind of in a transitional period where I'm hoping we will move to a point where more and more websites are clearly useful and some aren't. But it's rough out there now.
Mr. Spector for his comments tonight. And we also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned. Wow.